Willkommen zum New Work Chat Podcast von meinem Vater.
Heute mit John Stepper aus New York. Viel Spaß!
If we're going to survive as a species, we're going to have to figure out not how to use AI, but we're going to have to figure out how to get along. How do we not fall victim to our cognitive biases? And in, whether it's us and them, or whether it's the filter bubbles that we've created, and you have to quickly be able to be the kind of human being other people want to work with. And if you could do that, you'll get more done, you'll be happier, you'll be of greater service to the people around you and to the planet. Probably the number one skill is, can you cultivate authentic, trusting relationships quickly with almost anybody?
Und damit moin und schöne Grüße aus Rostock City. Herzlich willkommen zurück zum New Work Chat, dem Podcast für die neue Arbeitswelt. Mein Name ist Gabriel Rath. Ich mache das hier seit 2018. Ich bin Vater von 3 Töchtern und will herausfinden, wie die neue Arbeitswelt entsteht und was wir auch konkret dafür tun können, dass sie menschenfreundlicher wird. Ich habe hier schon mit mehr als 250 Menschen gesprochen. Liebe es, gute Fragen zu stellen. Ich glaube, wir können alle Podcaster oder Podcasterinnen sein. Es geht um gute Fragen in dieser neuen Arbeitswelt. Wir wissen alle nicht, wohin die Reise geht. Wir können sie aber mitgestalten. Und dieser Podcast soll einen Beitrag dazu leisten, soll inspirieren. Und ich hoffe, ihr könnt auch aus der heutigen Folge etwas mitnehmen. Ich erlebe immer wieder auch in meinem Umfeld, dass Menschen frustriert sind, genervt sind von ihrer Arbeit und richtig in einem Tief sind. Und mein heutiger Gast war auch in einem Tief, als er eine interessante Idee hatte. Er entwickelte die Graswurzelinitiative Working Out Loud, also eine ganz besondere Lernmethode zur Förderung von mehr Freude und von persönlicher Entwicklung am Arbeitsplatz. Working Out Loud, ich habe es 2016 kennengelernt, ist jetzt auch schon wieder eine ganze Weile her und habe es natürlich verfolgt, auch selbst kennengelernt. Es geht also um die Arbeit in einem Circle, 12 Wochen lang geht es darum, ein Ziel zu verfolgen, sich zu vernetzen, zu lernen und sich dabei zu unterstützen. Und das hat in Deutschland also richtig Fahrt aufgenommen. Ursprünglich mal gestartet bei Bosch mit Katharina Krenz federführend, die wird auch demnächst hier im Podcast sein. Und dann ist es wirklich in viele Unternehmen gegangen, bis in die Sparkassenwelt, in der ich es dann kennengelernt habe. Wie es allerdings auch zu kritischen Stimmen kam, was aus dem Business geworden ist, das John damit aufbauen wollte und wo die Reise heute im Jahre 2024 für John hingeht und welche Gedanken er sich auch über AI und Menschlichkeit macht, das hören wir heute im Podcast 238. Ich wünsche euch gute Unterhaltung, viel Inspiration. Ich habe schon beim Hören viel mitgenommen.
New Work Chat Werbung.
Support für diesen Podcast kommt von Desklee, der Desk-Sharing-Software und App für euch und eure Mitarbeitenden. Ich glaube, wir alle beschäftigen uns ja mit der Frage, wie wir besser hybrid zusammenarbeiten können, wie das möglichst einfach und flexibel geht. Und ich als Mitarbeitender wünsche mir eigentlich nur eine Lösung, eine App, in der ich sehen kann, wann ich ins Büro komme, wann sind Plätze frei, welche Räume sind frei. Und das würde ich mir dann einfach ganz gerne buchen wollen, flexibel. Und ich würde auch ganz gerne wissen, wann sind die anderen da, um mich vielleicht auch mit ihnen zu verabreden. Und das geht also alles in der App von Desklee, die ist weltweit im Einsatz bei Unternehmen wie Immowelt, in der Sparkassenwelt natürlich auch unterwegs, bei OMR, Eurowings, MAN, also kleine und große Unternehmen. Und das Schöne ist eben, dass ihr als Unternehmer auch seht, wie die Auslastung ist. Ihr habt auch Schnittstellen natürlich zu den großen HR-Plattformen, das ganze Datenschutz sicher, selbstverständlich. Lernt es mal kennen. Ich packe euch den Link in die Shownotes. und ich darf euch mein absolutes Lieblingsmagazin rund um New Work vorstellen. Die neue Narrative kommt zu euch im Abo, zu euch nach Hause oder auch in euer Unternehmen. Auch eine gute Idee für eure Mitarbeitenden, denn hier wird sehr, sehr ausführlich mit viel Liebe und auch mit Nachhaltigkeit das ganze Thema neues Arbeiten erklärt. Ich kann euch nur empfehlen, schaut euch das mal an. In der aktuellen Ausgabe geht es um das Thema Lernen oder besser gesagt auch die Frage, was können wir und müssten wir eigentlich verlernen? Das Schöne ist, dass der New Work Chat Podcast auch vorgestellt wird. Wir haben eine Partnerschaft und das geht wirklich gut Hand in Hand, denn auch der neuen Narrative geht es um eine menschenfreundlichere Arbeitswelt. Insofern passt das ganz gut. Checkt's mal aus. Ich packe euch den Link in die Shownotes.
Werbung Ende.
So, welcome to my podcast, New Work Chat. Really happy that John is here. Greetings from Rostock, Germany.
Greetings from downtown New York City. Gabriel, it's fantastic to see you. Thanks very much.
We were talking about it a few weeks ago, and now it's really happening. I was really looking forward to it. And like I told you, I really give my best with my English. I'm not doing this daily.
So far, so good.
So how are you, John?
Things are great. I was thinking about this call and how you and I have both been in and around this topic for a long time. And one of the things I'm guessing we'll talk about is what's changed. Mm-hmm. Like some things have stayed the same, maybe, mm-hmm. but a lot has changed both for us as individuals and then for what we're trying to do. So I was excited to talk to you.
So there are a lot of things we have to talk about. You know, here in Germany, you are the working out loud guy, but there is more. And we want to discover how did you do the last maybe months and years, maybe. We start right in the beginning. I have this question. My daughter, Matilda, she helps me with this podcast.
Oh, nice.
She introduces my guests.
How old is she?
10 years old.
Oh, wow. Perfect.
Yeah. You know, I have three girls and I know you're a dad too.
Yeah. I've got three girls. I know it's a blessing.
It's a blessing. We leave it to that. So how would you explain to Matilda, 10 years old, who you are and what you do?
Dear Matilda, what I try to do is to improve how people relate to each other at work, sometimes at home, so that they get along better, they work together better, they feel better. And sometimes when I do that, it changes how people actually view themselves. Maybe they're a bit more confident or a bit happier. And I think, you know, the world could use that today more than ever, just helping people get along, helping them see the best of other people and see the best of themselves.
In school, they're talking about professions. What are the dreams maybe? So what would you say? What's your profession?
Wow.
What would you tell her?
That's a deceptively difficult question. You know, if I had to give it a label, it might be corporate psychologist. It might be corporate trainer. It's something in between that. What I do is to take what we know about people, package it in such a way so that we could all develop new habits, new skills that can help us and help the people around us.
So do you remember when you were 10 years old?
Yeah.
So how would your world look like back then?
It was a lot simpler and a lot smaller. So where I grew up in the Bronx in New York City, almost no one went to college. Almost no one had a passport. Everybody looked the same. Kind of, it was all Italian Americans, most of whom their parents or grandparents came over like mine did on a boat from Italy. And you didn't think very much. You didn't think about, you know, to this question, what would your hopes or dreams be? Nobody asked you that. You got a job and that was it.
At least one.
At least one. Yeah. And there weren't that many different kinds like there are today. It seemed like there were a few different tracks or paths. Most people did kind of sort of the same thing. It was very much working class. And it was only until I was 13 or 14 and I went to high school in New York City, Manhattan, that I first even got exposed to what else was out there and other kinds of people. So 10-year-old John had a much smaller view of what the world could offer.
So we're talking about the 70s?
Something like that? If you're forcing me to tell how old, yes. So I was born in I was born in 1964. So yeah, in the 70s, exactly.
Because, you know, I'm socialized with hip-hop, and hip-hop was born in the Bronx in the 70s, I think, in 1973, something like this. And a lot of rappers are talking about the Bronx in the 70s, how wild it was, how criminal the days were.
Yeah, they're not lying.
So how did you experience it?
The Bronx is not all the same. Our particular area was almost like an episode of The Sopranos, if you know that show.
Yes.
It was largely run by organized crime. And so it was all white, all Italian. And because it was criminal, they made sure they didn't do anything in our neighborhood so that the police wouldn't come. They did it in other neighborhoods. So our growing up, we actually felt, in a strange way, safe. I didn't feel unsafe growing up. But for sure, all you had to do was, you know, ride your bike a few blocks, or God forbid, take the subway back in the 70s, which was horrific. You would be very aware that of the threat. It was a dirty and dangerous place back in the 70s. And, you know, it's certainly not perfect now, but it's much better in many ways and still challenging in many others.
What was your first job?
I love these questions. So we grew up, we didn't have much money. Nobody in our neighborhood did. And I was 13 years old. I worked in a carnival where they have, you know, games that people would play. We still used real money. So I would hand out change to kids who were playing these various games in a carnival. I worked in a snack bar, actually made food when I was 14. I picked up trash with the parks department. You did, you know, whatever you could, like, to make some extra money.
When I was going to school, there was this moment when we all went to a local center here and we had to take a test. And after, I don't know, 10 or 12 questions, there were these results.
Wow.
And these could or should be what we could do later on. But now it's much easier for our kids living in these days with the internet and just asking maybe ChatGPT, what's a good job for me with the right prompt, you know? So how did you find your way into the world of work?
It verges on ridiculous how I stumbled into what I did. But yet it's resulted in what I do now. So I went to Columbia University. My big break was going to a free high school in Manhattan that really exposed me to other people. It was a fantastic place, and that changed my life. And then I just I didn't really think. It was very unthinking how I chose things. It was more like what was presented to me, what came up. So it was almost coincidental. So there was a job at Bell Laboratories that offered free graduate school. I didn't even know what it was. It didn't matter. It allowed me to keep going to school. It was free. I would earn some money. And so I wound up working at Bell Laboratories for 7 years, working on a variety of IT things. I studied computer science, you know, before the internet. And then I wound up in, of all places, investment banks. Again, because I had written a book in 1993, somebody important at Morgan Stanley read a draft of it, and they hired me. Again, I didn't ask, what's my purpose? Is this really what I want to do? What's my intention? Like, none. I didn't answer the 12 questions. I didn't do any of that. They just presented me with an offer and I took it. And then I asked questions later. And my point there, or my learning, was, upon reflection, my career was really, was exactly that, not intentional. It was a series of roulette wheel spins. And sometimes I was lucky and sometimes I wasn't. And what I hope to offer with Working Out Loud is maybe a way, a structured way for people to explore what's out there and not just wait for something to appear, because the world is much richer than that. And you deserve more than just hoping for a good outcome.
But still, there are a lot of people unhappy at work to this day. Before we talk about how you developed Working Out Loud and how this movement went to Germany and so on, what do you think? How did work develop? Is there a difference, or is it still the work you have to do? Because there are so many opportunities, so many options. That's the topic of my podcast. But sometimes I think things don't change.
Yeah. And both you and I, I'm sure, we hope for a certain outcome or possibility. Mm-hmm. But, people have been talking about kind of the dehumanization of work for 60 years, like before computers were being introduced.
So it's not new, huh?
It is not new. And in fact, in some ways, I think it's gotten worse. And a writer in the UK, I think he lives in the UK, Alain de Botton, wrote about the pleasures and sorrows of work. And he talks about the myth of purpose. And I think if something's changed in the last 60 years, it's not so much work, although technology has certainly changed. It's not how we relate to each other in the workplace. It's that we have this different expectation about what we're supposed to get from it. So growing up, and certainly for my parents, that, you know, it wasn't about self-realization and there's a best job out there. And if I don't get it, I'm missing something. So you're kind of constantly unhappy. No, whatever it is you did, you tried to do well. You took pride in it, whether you worked at the coffee shop or you worked in a factory or you worked in an office. And that was good enough. That's what people did. And I think if anything has changed, which has made it worse, is that expectations are much higher. Like, I'm looking for something that feeds my soul, that feeds my sense, my need for purpose and fulfillment.
It's like a religion today sometimes, yeah, I think.
I'm not criticizing it. I mean, for God's sake, if you can get that, like, please do. It's just that it's increasingly rare and difficult to find. And so I think we're going to have to start looking other places, particularly if we're just playing career roulette and hoping that it comes, because it may never. And that's a terrible way to spend a career.
You know, I had my grandpa here in this podcast like 2.5 years ago. He was 89. Cool. Now he's 91.
Good genes.
Still lives with my grandma. She's 90.
That's good.
That's another story. But I asked him, how did you find your first job, your way? And he said, we lived in a small village. There was one shop. I went to the shop, worked there. So... And now we have like millions of opportunities. When I speak with my kids, you know, the little one wants to become a princess, of course. And for our kids or for the younger generations, it's on the one side, it's very good to have these options. But on the other side, it's like overwhelming.
Yeah, absolutely. There's the, you know, the famous paradox of choice. You give people too few choices, they're unhappy because they want to have self-determination, but you give them too many and they're overwhelmed and they don't make any choice. And that's true whether it's investing in retirement, you know, what fund to buy, or whether it's which brand of jelly to buy. And it's true for jobs and careers. If you're presented with infinite choice, you make no choice and you just kind of wait. I think increasingly, and this isn't a terribly original view, the way to look at a career is more as a portfolio of activities, so that you know, there will be some things that you do to earn a living. And you want to do those things well, and you'll, you know, there's certain, but that's over here. And then there may be something else that you do to feed your soul that's of service to other people. There may be something else that really where you're, it's all about learning. And I think we, most people don't have the skills for how to put that portfolio together, so to speak, how to manage it. But I think that's where you and I can maybe help people. Look, you're not searching for the one thing. There's not just one answer to your happiness at work. There's a set of answers, and there are many different sets or sets of possibilities. And here's, again, what I try to offer is here's a way to explore that space.
So what do you think is the most important future skill? Only easy questions today, John. Thinking of AI and thinking of all these things.
I mean, look, God, if I see another post about AI, I'm going to jump out the window. Because it is, you know what, here's why. So, of course, AI, you know, great, right? Like, we're living through an age, we don't even know how important this thing's going to be, right? Because it's going to go on some exponential curve, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
But here's the thing. If we're going to survive as a species, we're going to have to figure out not how to use AI, but we're going to have to figure out how to get along. How do we not fall victim to our cognitive biases, and in, whether it's us and them, or whether it's the filter bubbles that we've created? Like, how can we, and this is to answer your question, what skill do people really need? One of them is that when I'm trying to do something, that I have this skill that I can use the tools available, AI, internet, what have you, to find people and resources I need and to be able to build trust and a sense of relatedness with those people so that we can actually cooperate, whoever that is. And that art, we'll just call it the art of relationships for lack of a better word. I won't say networking, but for sure this ability, because we talked about portfolios, we talked about work being fragmented, you are going to come into contact with a wider and wider range of people outside of like your team. And you have to quickly be able to be the kind of human being other people want to work with. We have to quickly be able to develop some sense of connection with these other people so it's not just transactional or mean-spirited or competitive or whatever else. And if you could do that, you'll get more done, you'll be happier. You'll be of greater service to the people around you and to the planet. And that's why I think that's probably the number one skill is, can you cultivate authentic, trusting relationships quickly with almost anybody?
So looking back, what inspired you to create Working Out Loud?
Because my career was going that way. I mean, when your career is going this way, you know, you think you're a very smart person and that you're special.
You don't ask questions.
Exactly. Like, I guess, you know, I guess I deserve all this. And then when it wasn't going well, I realized, back to this expression, career roulette, like I was just lucky. And now I was unlucky. Because all it takes in the workplace is for one person, your boss, a customer, to just not like you or your work or both. And then you can go from hero to zero very quickly. Or the budget gets cut, or it's, you know, totally impersonal. Or somebody somewhere does something that shuts down your division or your business or whatever it might be. So why I developed it, I was looking for a way that when there's increasing uncertainty and ambiguity around you, was there a way that you could still exert some kind of control and shape your own reputation? So it wasn't just about what somebody said about you, with all, like a boss. Build your network so that when just your world would be bigger, right? You build your network, you have access to more opportunities, more possibilities, more ideas. And then and be a bit more confident. Like, I have a voice. I have something to say, which was the working out loud part. And that's why I built it, because I wanted those things. I felt that I had much more to offer at work than what than the box that I was in as I was going that way. And I stumbled onto a set of practices that now seem very familiar. Hey, how can I leverage technology to share my work, to be visible, to be helpful, to establish trust? Well, things we've been talking about. How can I do that? And then as I practiced that, well, you know, whatever, 10, 12 years ago, I turned it into a method so other people could learn how to do it too. That was the original motivation.
So it was, or maybe still is, about becoming independent?
It was, in the beginning, yes. It was meant to be, here's a way, and I didn't use this language then, but subsequently, here's a way that I could experience self-determination in the workplace. Autonomy, competence, relatedness, you know, these big three needs in self-determination theory. Here's a way I could fill those needs myself. I didn't have to get a certain job. I didn't have to get a certain boss. I didn't have to wait for the career roulette wheel to spin. I could I could do that myself together with a small number of people. Since then, I've used that, we'll call it a learning formula, right? Small groups, structured curriculum over time, individual goals. I applied that to other goals, to other audiences, to other settings.
So do you remember the first person you pitched it?
Oh, yeah.
And the reaction?
So what I did, because I was drinking my own champagne, I was on our, I was in technology, so I introduced this internal social network. So enterprise social networks were big at the time. And that allowed me to say, hey, I have this idea, and I offered one-on-one coaching. So my idea was, I needed to be long enough so that people would build habits. And I had a set of steps, you know, a rough set of steps, and I would do one-on-one coaching. So I offered that. There was a gentleman in Florida named Patrick Arnold, who was just a lovely guy. And there was a woman in Frankfurt named Barbara Schmidt. And I, you know, to this day, I'm in touch with Barbara, and who still works at Deutsche Bank. And it worked. Like, she was just lovely. It was awkward because I didn't know Barbara. And yet we wound up going through our 12 weeks together. And I said, this is really great, but it's so slow. I like to do one person at a time. And so after working with Barbara and learning from that, I tried to turn it into, well, could a group do this on their own? And thus they would need a coach or manager or someone, a facilitator. And it would, that would further reinforce their sense of self-determination and self-organization, which is what the company wants anyway. So that's when it went individual coaching to circles.
When I got to know Working Out Loud, it was 2016. I was working at a bank as well here in Rostock.
And if I could just pause there, the fact that something that I made found its way to Rostock, which I've never heard of until, you know, I met you, is still mind-blowing to me. Like, what a beautiful thing. And then yes. 8 years later, here we are, like, still talking about it. Like, that's great. So I'm very happy for that.
I never planned to work there, but I started as the new marketing guy who worked in social networks, in this whole field for some agencies in Hamburg. So coming back to Rostock, I took this challenge, and they had this new social intranet. And I think they were like the first Sparkasse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love the Sparkasse.
Who experimented with enterprise social network. And our friend Alexander Kluge showed us how. So I remember that was this day when he said, You know what? My wife, Sabine, wants to tell you something about working out loud. Because we had this circle of people who were like bringing the stuff into the teams, how to use the enterprise social network. So we said, okay, let's have Sabine, and she tells us whatever she wants to talk about. And then she told us about working out loud. It was about learning and working together and collaboration. We said, oh, sounds good. Makes sense. Let's try it. So we started, and then I read about it and got to know what was going on in other parts of Germany, in the south, of course. So maybe you tell us how and why you started in Germany, because it was a massive development then.
Again, I think it's ideas spread very often and behaviors via social networks. And so I can remember the exact moment when we had a conference call with in a Deutsche Bank office. There was a group of new work people in a Deutsche Bank conference room in Frankfurt. I was in my office at Deutsche Bank in New York. And we were talking about working out loud. It was, I don't know, maybe it was 2014, 2015. I'd been blogging about it. And there was a woman in the room, Katharina Krenz, who worked at Bosch. Mm-hmm. There were maybe 20 plus other people, Microsoft, maybe Continental was there, a few other people. And she said, great, let's try it. And she was the one, I really give her credit as being one of the first people to use it in a corporate setting, and then to see beyond just, hey, let's form circles, this would be a nice thing, but here's how to apply it to specific use cases, so that she could connect it to a business need, like whether it's talent development or onboarding or female empowerment. And she told her friends. So then I met Lucas at Daimler, and then I met Harold at Continental, and then the Jasper and Fabian at BMW, and so on and so on. Guys at Siemens. And I was going to Germany at one point 10 times a year, and it was great. And that's how I get to spend time with the Kluges, who are are still friends today. They're fantastic. Lucas, Sophia Rodiger, just a lovely bunch of people.
Like a community grew there.
A community did grow. It was very word of mouth. We didn't have sales or marketing. We didn't even have a product at the time. It had this feeling of being somewhat countercultural, so to speak, mm-hmm. not German culture, but corporate culture, that said, hey, I matter. It was very, very person-centric. It was very empowering as a method. And I think that attracted certain kinds of people who, if they liked it, told their friends and tried to spread it. And I'm grateful for that.
I had Alexander and Sabine Kluge here in this podcast. We talked about the interesting fact that this whole movement, not only of working out loud, but dealing with work, dealing with the purpose and all these things, it's really special in Germany. You know, like the whole term of new work, we don't have it in other parts of Europe or in the world. Yeah. So there seemed to be something like a wish or something like a need. And we had social networks like Twitter back in the days. I think that helped too, right?
When Twitter was good, yeah. Yeah, that's true. So, this culture question comes up a lot of, is there something different about Germany and Germans relative to new work, relative to my method? And I'm sure part of the answer is yes. I can imagine that. Hey, maybe they like the structure of it. Maybe there's something about their...
We love the rules.
a company like Bosch, for example, they've had people in 50 countries use it. And I think that the underlying needs that we're trying to fulfill of, hey, I want a bit more control. I want to learn and grow. I want a sense of connection to other people and to this place where I'm going to spend a lot of my life, my workday. Those are universal. And maybe those original guides I wrote, you know, maybe that doesn't appeal to every country. But for sure, this idea and this formula does. And so that's why, you know, since that 2016, I've developed, I don't know, four or five other of these methods for hospitals and factories and some other places, now universities. Because it's my aspiration isn't just to carry that thing I made and keep, but to reach as many people as possible and to help back to the mission, help them back to Matilda. Can we help more people improve how they relate to others, how they relate to themselves? Can we do that? And that's going to take a lot of different forms over the next decade or two decades.
The title of the book you wrote is Working Out Loud, a 12-week method to build new connections, a better career, and a more fulfilling life. Brings me to the question how work and life are related. Is there a life without work? Because my parents, they just reached the age of not having to work anymore. But luckily, they found new so-called jobs like helping others. And I think that's very important to have something, to do something, maybe for others. What do you think about it? Because on the other side, there seems to be a wish in all of us to just not work, just being lazy. But I think we need work. It's very human.
Yeah. 100%, you're right. In fact, the name of my company is this Japanese word, ikigai, which is the reason we get up in the morning, right? It's about purpose. Now, your purpose doesn't have to be to go to a corporation and do a job and get paid every 2 weeks. That doesn't have to be your purpose. But for many of us, that's a practical reality. What I think, do people need work? I'm going to say, what people need, back to that self-determination theory, is they need to be, we're goal-oriented creatures, right? So we need to have some kind of thing to do, to accomplish. So we need to be active agents in our lives. That's autonomy. We need to grow and learn and get things done. That's competence. And boy, we really need other people. Like if there's one factor in all of the health, you know, do's and don'ts, it's have a robust social network and set of relationships. So work can tick all of those boxes for many, many people. And then if you don't need the money, you still need some kind of work that gives me autonomy, competence, and relatedness. You still need something to do that's goal-oriented, that helps you grow, that keeps you connected. And that could be, you know, with your grandkids. That could be doing something in the community. That could be, but it's certainly not, you know, sitting on the beach sipping pina coladas. At least not all the time.
So it's about how to find out what the purpose is, or what my purpose is, or what your purpose is.
Yes, and so I think about this a fair amount. I think the purpose question, I would advise myself and other people that you can search for purpose out there. Like your 8 or 10 questions you did in Rostock Elementary. What should I be? What should I do? Right. But boy, that's a very difficult question to answer, and you may never answer it. Or the answers might change as work changes. So my recommendation would be, while you do that, while you are open to other things that may give you a sense of purpose, other opportunities, other kinds of jobs, actively look for purpose in what you are already doing. And Martin Luther King gave a speech, you know, probably 60 years ago. If you sweep the streets, be the best street sweeper there is. Find purpose in that. And he certainly wasn't telling them to keep them in their place, sort of say, don't dream big. But what? Don't wait. Don't wait for purpose to discover you. And that's what Alain de Botton was saying in The Myth of Purpose. It's like we've all been fed this, like there's this thing out there, live your best life. And it's somehow your fault if you don't find it.
Your best version.
Yeah. And again, by all means, dream big, have aspirations, etc. In the meantime, like don't put happiness on hold while you're searching, while you're exploring, while you're being open. Then actively look for what could fulfill you in exactly what you're doing now. And that could be just with the people around you. That could be in your community. That could be with family. That could be with colleagues. But do both.
Mm-hmm. So for those who are listening today who don't know what working out loud is, how would you describe it in one or two sentences? I'm sure there are some who are curious now.
I'm sure.
What's the secret?
So how does it work? All of our methods, you start with an individual goal, something that you care about. And then together with three or four other people, you each pursue your goals following a structured curriculum over time. And you do that by meeting an hour a week. Sometimes it's 12 weeks, sometimes it's 8, depending on the method. And it's a guided mastery program. It's your learning skills, you're learning by doing. And in the original method, you are building relationships related to that goal that can help you make progress. But that formula, this call it social learning, call it peer learning, of I start with me and a goal that I care about, usually in a specific frame that we give you. And then you're pursuing that in a structured way, step by step, week by week, together with the support of other people, helps you make progress, helps you build relationships, help you build confidence. Again, tapping into those big three needs for self-determination.
And it's about building habits as well. I read that the 12 are like the time you need to establish a habit. This is true?
The science is a little fuzzy. There's certainly no precise date. Look, I could try to work on my yoga habit or meditation habit. It could take me years, right? But for sure, consistent practice over a period of, call it 8 to 12 weeks is a hell of a good start to getting something in your head, particularly if you're doing it consistently and regularly with the support of other people. So that time frame is good. For many people, I think they develop some new habits. They develop maybe even more important, kind of a different mindset. Because they've been doing this for an hour a week, for 12 weeks with other people, doing, discussing, kind of gets into their head about how they view what work could be, how they think about their approach to other people, how they view themselves and their contributions. All of that can shift pretty surprisingly in those 8 to 12 weeks.
Because we are reading books like Tiny Habits or these James Clear books.
Yeah.
Yes, they are on the lists and then we go back to our normal life. We would like to start something. We would like to, run, maybe do sports. And then our normal life comes, our job, our routines. So for me, the question is how to break out of these routines. And maybe we are there for each other to help us leaving these routines then.
Yeah. We was the key word you just used. The reason why I've embraced this learning formula is changing human behavior. It's not impossible. It's really hard. It's really hard to change behavior. It's really hard to change people's minds about almost anything. It's really hard to overcome cognitive biases, et cetera, et cetera. So one of the most effective, the books you mentioned are great. It's hard to learn from a book because you have to experience it. And so what I've tried to do is leverage the power of these social groups because it gives you structure. We meet every Friday at 2:00. Shared accountability. Gabriel's going to show up. I better do, I better look at this week's thing. And support, which says, look, what? It's just help. let's go. Come on. You said you wanted to go. Let's go. Oh, I don't want to. No, come on. Mm-hmm. It's not enough. It's not a magic bullet. But if you take some of the tricks in those books and you combine it with a social group that's actually doing the work, that's actually practicing the habit week by week over 8 to 12 weeks, your chances go way up that you'll actually cultivate that habit and maybe change your mind.
So I can imagine that you did hundreds of circles. So my question is, what did you learn about yourself?
This may be due to a number of factors. What the circles helped for sure, they helped me to be much more open to other people, much less judgmental. I can't tell you how many times I'd be in a circle and you think you know somebody, or you think that, you know, they're going to be helpful or not helpful or whatever it is. And boy, after a few weeks of peeling away the layers of the onion, you realize, oh, I had no idea what this person was really like. And I've learned that I could, we're much more alike than we are different once you peel away those layers. And that I truly believe that everybody has something valuable to contribute and to offer, even if it's just attention and appreciation and how valuable those are. So I think I've always liked people, but I feel like this method has really given me a lens to see what's good about people and to really reserve and withhold judgment, but work instead to see what's behind those layers, if I can.
So talking about working self-determined or maybe independent, how did you develop your business with working out loud?
So it was painful because it started off as, hey, I'll put something on the internet and, you know, good luck. I hope you like it. That was nice. I got laid off by Deutsche Bank in 2016, a month after I gave that TEDx talk, which is kind of funny. And so I had a choice to make. Like, I can go back to try to get a job in an investment bank, which I really did not want to do. Or I could try to make this into a business. And I had no idea what I was doing. I mean, again, you know, back to where I grew up, I just grew up with like this five choices and you pick one of those. I had no exposure to how people did this. So I was very, very naive. Luckily, my wife works, is a successful career, is super supportive. And she knew what I was doing and said, and encouraged me to try it. So here's the thing. At some point, I had to make a decision of what do I want to be and what difference am I trying to bring about? Because it is very nice to make things, give them away for free, have people say nice things about you, and then like be in...
But you have to pay the bills.
You have to pay the bills. Absolutely. And what I felt was, I remember people would tell me, or ask me, and it wasn't quite positive. They said, is this a religion? Because people working out loud were so into it. Oh, you have to try it. And so in the early days, it attracted a certain kind of person, a lovely kind of person, but this kind of, I use the word countercultural, a corporate rebel type of person. And I loved that. We had wall conferences and it was beautiful, really. We had wall of corns, unicorns, based on working out loud. But what we were absolutely missing is we weren't really part of the workplace. We were kind of on the side. We were this nice to have for people who think a certain way. And what I really wanted to do, I wanted to reach a much broader audience than that. I didn't want it to be for just new work people, mm-hmm. all drank from the same, same champagne. And so I turned it into a business. We package it so that it's really aimed at companies. And I developed new methods. So now, like I said, we have methods for operational workers, methods for teams, methods for wellness, for resilience. But, or and, we still do other things. And this is largely due to Katarina Krenz, who says, we have to preserve our sense of mission. So we have a business, focuses on companies, focuses on employees. It's, you know, talent development, onboarding, all of the use cases that she had in mind. And that makes some money. And we have a dozen coaches who distribute it in Germany, Switzerland, Austria. But then we do other things. Not because it's just out on the internet, but because there are good things to do. So she does this Frauenstarken program, which is for female empowerment.
Yes.
I could tell you it makes close to zero money because they give it away. they either give the program away to a lot of free seats, or they charge a small amount and then they give it to a fantastic charity. And she's reached 6,000 women with that program. I mean, it's beautiful.
I remember when this movement had its peak, maybe even in the media, because a lot of newspapers wrote about it and hyped it, like we say. And then we had some people, I saw them on Twitter, who are using it, calling themselves VOL consultants. And I'm sure they did not know you or Katarina. They just wanted to make their business out of your idea, which was not a business back then.
Right.
So I totally understand why you did what you did. But on the other side, there was this moment on Twitter when Twitter was Twitter. I remember that a lot of people asked this question, oh, it's not free anymore. Why? They did not understand it.
Yeah.
They did not
get that. I mean, if I used, I don't know, Spotify or Netflix or whatever it is for free, and then Spotify or Netflix says, oh, actually, we want you to, you're going to charge you, you'd be irritated. what are my intentions? My intentions are, can we improve how people relate to each other in the workplace? And if you're going to do that, it's not with a bunch of free guides on the internet.
You
have to scale, and you have to integrate yourselves into the business. You can't be kind of alongside or outside or just volunteers. But for the folks who are critical, I listen. I mean, I may not like it, but I listen. And I think what you'll see is that's what I've taken that and said, you know what? We still can do more than just this business. And so, back to whether it's Frauenstarken or some work we're doing at universities, but we do it in a more purposeful way than just putting it on the web, like some open source. So we don't do that anymore. And I'm very comfortable doing that because I want to do it well. I think it's almost lazy to say, here it is, good luck. I would rather work myself or with our coaches, with the universities, with the nonprofits, with the female empowerment, the public programs. I would much rather do that. That's both fulfilling for me, and it's a much, much better experience for the participants. So I'll do that.
So we talked a lot about Germany, but what happened in the US? Were there companies using it, learning with it?
Not nearly as many. I'd say three things. One is, the key word is yet. They're not using it yet. I've got a lot of, I'm happy to work on this for a very long time. We don't have a Katarina Krenz and a Bosch yet here. So that the kind of linchpin that connects you to other companies that helps it to spread, that's one. Part of it could also be cultural. That could be. But I think mainly, going to what I said earlier, these things spread via social networks. It's a very different social network here than it is in Germany. We don't have sales and marketing, so I've yet to figure out how to do that. Hopefully next year we'll have a female empowerment network program in English that's international. And, you know, we're just going to keep trying different ways to access different countries, different cultures, different audiences. And so not yet, but we're working on it.
So we had Corona, which changed a lot.
I remember.
In the world of work. So what do you think? What are the better sides now? Where are the chances now?
So the obvious ones. Nobody questions anymore that virtual work works. It may not be 100%, and yes, in person is a different thing. But this idea of we can do something productively via products like we're using now was still somewhat suspicious, and now it's not. So that's very liberating, both in terms of individual flexibility, but also in terms of how work gets organized and done. I think it's also pushed, or at least has provided more fertile ground for the sharing of work at work. I mean, it's been a long time. How many decades have people been complaining about meetings and we should really work in this asynchronous way and enterprise social networks or Slack? They're popular, but it hasn't made much of a dent. And I think there's room for what we do, or what's been missing, is that just sharing work, just working out loud for that sake to share, is not enough. Like, what's been missing is this intrinsic motivation of, well, why should I? Like, what would I get from it? And from the circles, it's just one method that can show you, hey, here's how you benefit personally from doing this. You increase your opportunities, you feel better, you have more connections, you have more control. And so we answer the what's in it for me behind this behavior that companies want of, can you make your work visible so that we can go faster and innovate faster? So I think COVID has shifted our mindset about how we get work done. I think we're still lagging in kind of humanizing that, doing it in a way that it's human friendly, and answering the what's in it for me question so that people feel like they're genuinely benefiting from working this way, not just so that they can stay home.
So when do you decide to meet a person in the office or like in real life, and when do you use like a video conference?
For what I do, I work out of New York City, and a lot of the people I work with are far away. So there's not much of a choice. Having said that, when someone says, oh, hey, I'm going to be in town, I will go out of my way to see them in person. Because it's a different thing. It's richer. There's a physicality to it. So much higher bandwidth communication, much more intimate. Someone who I've worked with often will be in town. She's in Iowa. We're doing an experiment together. She's going to drive here 3 hours, and we're going to spend half a day walking on the High Line, having a dinner. Why not a Zoom call? I could just call Iowa because we're human beings.
It's like 2D, not 5 or 6D.
Yeah. It will certainly accelerate the development of trust and a connection. That's one. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, I meet in person when I can. When we're in the same, proximate location, I will go out of my way to do that. Otherwise, I make heavy use of the tools, but I realize that it's a different kind of medium.
Coming back to our start, it's about relationships. In my experience, it's easy to work with people you know via the tools, but it's hard to build a relationship. Or harder.
It's harder. And yet, there are certainly a set of learnable skills, learnable techniques that can make it easier, that can make you feel more comfortable and also be more effective at building trust with somebody. We know a lot more about human behavior than when you and I were picking careers. Like, why do people do what we do? We know a lot more about that, but very, very little of that has found its way into the workplace. And so, you know, one way of describing to Matilda what I do is I take what science knows about people and how they relate to each other, and I try to package it so that they actually practice that in ways that help them like each other, get along, cooperate, and feel good at the same time.
So I told you about my grandpa, 91 years old.
That's great.
What do you want to remember looking back later and being just happy with what you did? Do you think even about age?
Yeah. Yes. It's funny that you bring this up, because this is something I've been thinking more intensely about. And my answer, which may be deeply dissatisfying, but is one that I find fulfilling, is I don't need to leave any kind of legacy. Like, you know, you made this much, or you did this, or you won this, or whatever it is. Like, genuinely, I don't. Because there'll always be people who have more, or people forget, or... If I had a legacy to leave, it would be that he was a good man, that I was a good man. And to me, that means you were kind to other people, you were of service to other people, right? You were positive and encouraging and kind. And yeah, you made some kind of difference, but it doesn't have to be big. It's just when they think of you, they think, well, we could use more like him. Like, the world was a better place because he was around. And whether it's a better place in a small way, like with your family, or whether it's a larger way with your work, that would be a great outcome if folks said that when I was gone. And I've still got some work to do. But hopefully, if I reach your grandpa's age, which I fully intend to do, I've got a number of decades to be a good man and to try to make a difference.
What makes you angry? Are there moments?
Oh, yeah. What makes me angry? So what makes me angry, I think, is, and still motivates me, actually is one of my work motivators, is unfairness or injustice. That makes me angry, is the kind of polarized dialogue that we have that's just kind of this dehumanizing, purposely divisive rhetoric that drives people apart, that reinforces us and them. Like, that really makes me angry, particularly when the thems are disenfranchised. You know, the immigration, or the homeless, or the, you know, whatever the label is, or certainly politically, that makes me angry. I've realized that anger is not going to do very much, or me being upset or reading the news, so I try to channel that into, okay, there are a bunch of people out there who are using technology to amplify and reinforce the sense of us and them. And so I'm going to try and do the opposite. I'm going to try and diminish that sense of us and them, and create things that improve how people relate to each other, that take this tendency to us and them and instead make a bigger us. And so that's what I could do. I may not be able to change who's president, or, you know, or what the robots are doing on Twitter. But I can make these methods that people seem to like, that bring people closer together, that help us see the better angels of our nature. I can do that, and I want to keep doing that.
I like the idea of being angry and motivated at the same time to do some good work. I think that's very good. Not just saying, okay, that's unfair. Okay, that's, you know, manipulated and so on. But really thinking about the next step, what to do about it, because I think anger is some amount of energy maybe you could use.
Right. And it's with, I guess it's important to, for me anyway, to realize, well, what's within my control? And just being angry at who's running for president, like, there's really not mm-hmm. much I can do about that. I could vote, but, you know, besides that. And so, again, well, what's in my control? Well, here are things that I could do. And it doesn't have to just be work. It could be, like I said, in a portfolio. It could be in other aspects of my life. But if you could channel that energy, to your point, it is an energy. And if you can channel it into some kind of positive action, almost no matter what that action is, but that's a net positive. And if more of us did that, instead of just, you know, participate in this negativity, if more of us did that, then yeah, the world would be a better place. And we'll have human beings on the planet for longer than we might otherwise.
Because a lot of people think, who am I? But yeah. Your idea reached me in Rostock. You talked about guys like Martin Luther King, Muhammad Ali, and so on. There are a lot of people who started with small steps, and then we had something like a butterfly effect. So I like thinking big. We can reach more than we think.
That's right. And if each of us helped two other people, if the arithmetic was that simple, if each of us reached two other people, that'd be quite an accomplishment. It would be a positive shift. So you do what you can with what you have. And then you see where it goes, kind of like without expectations. And if I've learned, there's been a shift for me over the past, you know, few years. It's just less about expectations, like what I should do and what I should accomplish and all that, and more about, let's just do the work, and whatever happens, happens. But I'm gonna have good intentions. I'm gonna put in the effort. I'm gonna be open to ideas, open to other people, open to feedback. And then you keep going, and that's it. Like, that's the purpose. The purpose is not the outcome. The purpose is doing that well-intentioned work and doing it together with other people like yourself. And we'll see what difference we make. But there is courage in the attempt. And I'm going to do
enjoy the ride, so to say.
Genau. Exactly right.
Genau. Maybe the last question, how do you learn? Because we talked about future skills, adapt, learn. How do you do it?
So my primary reading is learning is books. So I just love books. I realize that that's nice. It's limiting. And so I try to force myself to be open to, well, what are new things. So just recently I finished this, a video series, a class from Stanford University on human behavior by my favorite author. I had read his books and now I graduated to actually taking the class, so to speak. And now I've done this deep dive into the world of videos and podcasts and whatnot. And of course, what's the next step is, hey, how can I apply? I'm going to say it. How can I apply AI to my work? Because of course it's good, and I don't know yet how it's going to use it, how I'm going to use it. But as an advisor, as a source of ideas, as a source of feedback and criticism, it's a great tool. And to answer your question, I love reading books. I love getting recommendations from other people, but I'm mindful that that only takes me so far. And so I'm always looking for, well, what's another way? And that could be alternative media. It could be AI. It could be just a conference, workshop, other art form. And I try to make that part of my mental diet, so to speak, as best I can.
So what's your favorite book?
Who's my favorite child? Like, there's no answer to that, Gary.
Pick one.
I will pick one. So, and it's a recent one where it says, Robert Sapolsky, Sapolsky. Robert Sapolsky is my favorite thinker at the moment. I've read all of his books. He's a professor at Stanford. He writes about the biology of human behavior. humans at their best and worst. And his latest book is called Determined. And his previous book was called Behave. But these are books that really elevate you, the reader, in multiple ways in terms of your understanding of science, molecular biology, neuroscience, genetics, and why humans do what they do, motivation, causes, judgment, empathy. So it's science, it's history, it's practical applications to human behavior. Robert Sapolsky, Determined, or the book prior, mm-hmm. Behave. 5-star books. I watch anything and I read anything this guy puts out.
Thank you very much, John. We will put it in the show notes, of course. Very last question. Let's say we meet again in maybe 1 year. What will we talk about?
So I'd hope we talk about the results of experiments that we're doing now. So we're doing things with people in factories in Germany. And we're doing this experiment. I just shared something about it today in Iowa. It's a kind of wellness program using one of our methods for people in Iowa, so they're not in companies. And I don't know if this is going to work. I know that they are designed to serve audiences that don't often get attention, that don't often get opportunities or access for development. And I want to give them that. And so we're working with a few companies in Europe, shop floor workers, people in operational jobs. And we're doing this thing in Iowa. And I would hope a year from now we're saying, we learned so much. And, you know, it worked okay, but now it's going to work better. And we're on version 3. And we keep going. And back to, you know, having a portfolio. It's great to have a corporate business. It's even greater to be able to serve people who don't get served very often. And I'd like to do both. Hmm.
Thank you very much, John.
It was really a pleasure talking to you.
And maybe one time you'll come to Rostock. Because I have been to New York. Now it's your turn.
Yes, now it's my turn. A good friend, I think Lübeck is not that far away. Is that right?
No, maybe one hour.
And I know the Klugers have a place in the Baltic Sea, which I've been...
Yes, that's an hour to the other
direction. I've been trying to get myself invited, but no chance yet. So maybe we could do maybe we could figure something out.
And then we do another podcast with the Klugers and with yes. you in Arizona.
And I hope to meet... by that point, 11-year-old Matilda at the time. This was really a pleasure.
That would be
Thank
great.
You very, very much.
Stay healthy. That's what I tell my guests. That's very important. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you.
Greetings to New York.
Take good care of yourself.
Thank you, John. Bye.
Bye.
Und damit sind wir schon am Ende der heutigen Episode, diesmal zweisprachig. Deutsch und Englisch, mal schauen, was da noch so geht. Auf jeden Fall werde ich mein Englisch ein bisschen auffrischen und ich freue mich natürlich, wenn ihr mir auch euer Feedback gebt. Schreibt mir doch mal eine E-Mail über meine Webseite gabrielrath.com. Können wir ganz schnell in Kontakt kommen. Ihr könnt mich auch gerne über LinkedIn kontaktieren. Auch da nochmal der Link natürlich in den Shownotes. Vernetzt euch gern, schreibt mir, wie es euch gefallen hat. Wo ihr den Podcast hört, finde ich auch immer spannend, welche Folgen euch besonders gut gefallen haben. Und wenn ihr mögt, dann supportet doch auch diesen Podcast, denn wir wollen die Show noch viel, viel größer machen. Und das lebt am Ende des Tages wirklich auch von dieser Community. Mittlerweile sind es ja wirklich Leute in vielen Ländern auch, die hier zuhören. Und ja, ihr könnt diesen Podcast bewerten mit 5 Sternen auf Spotify oder auch Apple Podcasts. Da hören die meisten zu. Und ihr könnt dort auch eine Rezension schreiben. Das ist sehr einfach und schnell gemacht und hilft mir sehr, denn dann steigen wir in den Rankings und noch mehr Leute hören zu. Ihr könnt den Podcast natürlich auch teilen in den sozialen Netzwerken. Lasst es andere wissen. Und ja, kommt auch gern auf mich zu, wenn ihr mit mir zusammenarbeiten wollt. Das könnt ihr im Podcast selbst tun. Ihr kommt als Werbepartner an Bord, wenn ihr wollt. Da schicke ich euch gern mal das Pitch Deck zu. mit allen Zahlen, Daten, Fakten zum Podcast, wie viele hören da monatlich zu, wer hört zu und so weiter und so fort. Und wir können auch anders zusammenarbeiten, indem ihr mich bucht. Ich bin Moderator nicht nur dieses Podcasts, sondern auch von Veranstaltungen verschiedener Art, Corporate Events, Konferenzen, alles macht mir Spaß. Und ich bin auch als Keynote Speaker unterwegs, packe ich euch mit in die Shownotes. Insofern kommt gerne auf mich zu mit Feedback, mit Ideen, wie wir zusammen was starten können. Und vielleicht kann ich euch sogar helfen, euren eigenen Podcast zu starten oder euer eigenes Personal Branding auf LinkedIn und Co. so richtig an den Start zu bringen. Ich teile da also auch meine Erfahrung, all das, was ich in meiner Arbeit gelernt habe. Nächste Woche Freitag geht es dann weiter mit der nächsten Folge. Und bis dahin bleibt gesund und bleibt connected.